From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Chile's caravan of death, 25 years after he participated in the summary execution of dozens of political prisoners, a feared official of Pinochet's secret police, now living in Florida, is sued by his victim's family. Yasser Arafat meets with President Clinton. We'll take a look at the almost daily bombings of Iraq and the imminent attack on Yugoslavia. Finally, a feminist comic on this age of technology. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke has ended a second round of talks with Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Holbrooke is hoping to get Milosevic to agree to the autonomy pact ethnic Albanians signed last week. Holbrooke reported no progress from his talks with Milosevic yesterday, and it's not clear if there will be any further meetings with Milosevic. Meanwhile, key members of Congress will meet with President Clinton this morning while the Senate resumes debate on a measure that could undermine the president's policy in Kosovo. There are deep divisions in Congress over the president's plan for military intervention in Kosovo. One of the nation's top universities acknowledged yesterday that female professors suffer from pervasive discrimination. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology said that for years, female faculty members there were on the short end of the stick when it came to promotions, salaries, office space, and access to research money. MIT said it raised women's salaries an average of 20% to equal the salaries of male faculty members, increased research money and space for women, and awarded them key positions on faculty committees to correct the problem. A human rights group plans to march on Washington against police brutality while calling on President Clinton to do more in addressing the issue. And the Reverend Al Sharpton says he plans to get himself arrested and stage a jail hunger strike until four white police officers who killed Amadou Diallo in New York, an unarmed Guinean immigrant, are indicted. Ron Daniels, head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, urged President Clinton to hold a string of town meetings to discuss the policies that helped to fuel what he called a police brutality crisis. Daniels said yesterday the National Emergency March for Justice is set for April 3rd, marking the 31st anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Meanwhile, New York Police Commissioner Howard Safer was forced to defend his officers at a city council hearing into the police department's street crime unit yesterday. Before the hearing, Safer's aide said that he might not testify at the city council hearing because of a scheduling conflict. But after being photographed at the Oscars ceremony in Los Angeles on Sunday night, the commissioner flew back to New York to attend the hearing at City Hall. And as the hearing took place, 141 people were arrested in the largest act of civil disobedience protesting the police shooting of Diallo. Among those arrested were the New York State Comptroller, the highest black elected official in the state, as well as the publisher of Black Enterprise and Essence magazines. Bombing suspect Eric Robert Rudolph may have broken into up to 12 mountain homes to steal food and toilet paper, sometimes just to get a shower and a shave, this according to a federal agent. Rudolph is the suspect in a fatal Birmingham, Alabama women's health clinic bombing last year and others in Atlanta. The break-ins from July to January were very similar and happened in a defined area. Hundreds of agents have been engaged in a manhunt in a forest in western North Carolina. A Y2K computer glitch delivered a windfall to 194,000 New Jersey welfare recipients whose accounts were accidentally credited with millions of dollars in food assistance allotments. A test Sunday to determine whether a state welfare computer was protected from the so-called Millennium Bug caused the error. This according to a spokesperson for the New Jersey State Department of Human Services. Officials weren't sure how the April 1st benefits were made available. As much as $58 million may have been involved, the New York Times today reported that the unexpected credits totaled $30 million. A proposed new preamble to Australia's constitution made public today is drawing criticism for not explicitly recognizing the Aborigines' prior custodianship of the land. The term implies ownership before colonial occupation, which Prime Minister John Howard wanted to avoid. Opposition Labor Party leader Kim Beazley said the preamble must include acknowledgement of Aboriginal custodianship to get his party's support. One Aboriginal elder called the draft preamble an insult to Indigenous Australians. And the two-star admiral in charge of the Navy's air forces in the Mediterranean was formally relieved of his duties yesterday after an investigation found he had had an adulterous affair with a civilian and then lied about it to investigators. The officer is named Rear Admiral Paul Sempko. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Amid political tension and signs of military unease, Chileans are awaiting tomorrow's ruling by Britain's House of Lords on the fate of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. He's facing extradition to Spain on charges of genocide and torture stemming from human rights abuses during his 1973 to 1990 dictatorship. Meanwhile, a human rights group here in the United States has filed a civil lawsuit against one of Pinochet's right-hand men. He's a retired Army major named Armando Fernandez Larios. Although his name may not be as familiar as Pinochet's, Fernandez Larios is well known both to Chilean human rights activists and to those who are familiar with the 1976 assassination of the former Chilean defense minister Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. As a member of Pinochet's feared secret police, known as the DINA, Fernandez Larios was named in a 1977 federal indictment as one of the co-conspirators in the Letelier car bombing, which also killed Ronnie Moffitt, Letelier's American assistant. Fernandez Larios has been in the United States since he provided information to U.S. officials in 1987 regarding the roles of Pinochet and DINA officials in the Letelier assassination. He struck a plea bargain with U.S. government prosecutors, pleading guilty to having served as an accessory after the fact in the bombing. He currently lives in Miami, Florida. The civil lawsuit was filed in a federal court in Miami by the San Francisco-based Center for Justice and Accountability, as well as by family members of victims. It alleges that in his capacity as a member of DINA, Fernandez Larios participated in a series of killings that became known in Chile as the Caravan of Death. Fernandez Larios has publicly acknowledged belonging to the military squad that conducted at least 72 summary executions of political prisoners in northern Chile in the month following the 1973 military coup headed by Pinochet, which toppled the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. The suit's plaintiffs are the mother and siblings of one of those political prisoners killed in the Caravan of Death, Winston Caballero, who was a regional planning director under Allende. We're joined right now by Zita Caballero, sister of Winston Caballero and plaintiff in the lawsuit. Also, Sean Roberts, legal director of the Justice and Accountability Project, which is the San Francisco-based group, which is helping to pursue human rights violators in the United States. Zita Caballero, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. The last name is Cabello.
Cabello.
Cabello, yes.
Okay. Tell us about your brother and what happened.
Well, my brother, he was the director of regional planning in the city of Copiapó. He was 20 years old. And the day after the coup, the Oscar Gag, the commander in charge of the region, called him and all these officials to a meeting. And after the meeting, Oscar Gag did not leave my brother go home, but he sent him immediately to prison without any specific charge. And more than a month, he was in prison, and we never thought he would be in any danger. And actually, he was supposed to be released, and that the week of October 17th. And on Tuesday, October 16th, he called my mother and said that he had been told that he would be released that coming weekend. But that night, General Stark, with Fernandez Larios and another military official, came into Copiapó, and that night they selected 13 people to be executed, and one of them was my brother Winston. And the only news we received was that in the newspaper they published a news saying that the 13 political prisoners had been executed because they were trying to escape when they were transferred to another detention facility. And that was the only news we received, and we never received the bodies.
Sean Roberts, your legal director of the Justice and Accountability Project. Can you talk about the legal basis, though it seems like it shouldn't be hard to find a legal basis here, but under which you are suing Fernandez Larios?
A lawsuit is possible in the United States under two...
Speak up as loud as you can, please.
Okay. The lawsuit is possible here in the United States under the Alien Tort Claims Act and the Torture Victim Protection Act, which make it possible for U.S. courts to have jurisdiction over cases of human rights violations committed overseas. So that's how the case is brought into the U.S.
And why now?
Now, because in about December of last year, our center was contacted by the Cabello family. They had just learned through rumors in the Chilean community that Fernandez Larios was reported to be living in Florida. And so we hired an investigator to check into that rumor and see whether or not it, in fact, was true. Discover that it was possible to attempt to serve him. We actually filed the suit last month, in the middle of last month, in Miami in the Federal District Court. But he is keeping quite a low profile, and it took us almost a month to serve him.
I want to ask all our guests to speak as loud as you can. We're also joined by Saul Landau, Hugh Labonte, Chair of Interdisciplinary Applied Knowledge at California State Polytechnic University at Pomona. He's also been a Pacifica Radio News commentator for many years and wrote Assassination on Embassy Row about the Letelier Moffett murder. Welcome, Saul.
Hi, Amy.
Can you talk more extensively about Fernandez Larios and who he is?
Yes, he's a very slippery fellow who we first hear about him through Michael Townley, who was the assassin of Letelier and several other people. Townley worked for DINA, which was the Chilean secret police intelligence operation after the coup in 1973. Most of the DINA personnel that were recruited were military people, like Fernandez Larios, but Townley was an electronics gadget man. And together with Fernandez Larios, he was assigned by then head of DINA, Colonel Contreras, to carry out extraterritorial missions, which meant murders abroad or assassinations. And the first job that they did, in other words, they picked these people because they were known killers. And Fernandez Larios, who later on almost cried before a U.S. court that he really didn't do anything except a little lousy surveillance, lousy in the sense that he didn't do it right, was one of these killers. And he certainly was a member of Arellano Stark's Caravan of Death march. But in 1974, Fernandez Larios worked with Michael Townley to set up and execute the assassination of General Prats. General Carlos Prats was the former Chilean chief of staff who was exiled in Buenos Aires. They worked with a group of Argentine Nazis who were working then in the Argentine secret police to plant a bomb under Prats' car. And when Prats and his wife came home, I think it was September 30th of 1974, as they were about to enter the garage of their condominium, one of these Argentine secret policemen activated the detonator, and they blew the Prats 9 stories high. So that's the first known assassination in which Fernandez Larios plays a part. And the operation, Amy, of this DINA extraterritorial group was quite, it was almost one of the thrillers, because these guys would take false names and travel on false Chilean passports and then go to another country, like, say, Paraguay. And in Paraguay, they would receive false and official Paraguayan passports. And Fernandez Larios received one of these official false Paraguayan passports along with Michael Townley in 1976 in June. The purpose was to go to the United States and assassinate Orlando Letelier. That particular caper didn't work. They carried it out successfully 3 months later. So Fernandez Larios is a known killer. And the United States, even the judge, by the way, who heard the case, was very skeptical about his pleas of innocence. He came to the United States because he feared for his life. Now, what was going on in Chile after the Letelier trials began in Washington, and this was now 4 years after the assassination, Fernandez Larios was still a member of the Chilean military, formally. DINA had been disbanded. This was after 1977, and a different secret police replaced it. So Fernandez Larios and all of the other conspirators, other than Townley, were all getting a little bit nervous because Townley had named them. So obviously, the FBI got in touch with Fernandez Larios and spirited him out of Chile. They picked him up in Brazil and brought him to the United States, where he plea bargained and got himself a suspended sentence, an unbelievable case. But he was the only man who actually implicated General Pinochet in his testimony, not in the murder per se, but in the cover-up of the murder. In his testimony before a federal judge, Fernandez Larios stated that Pinochet had called him into his office and told him to go along with the cover-up plans and that he would be rewarded for doing so, and that if he didn't, he might get into trouble. Fernandez Larios took this as a death threat, and that's one of the reasons he left Chile. And I'm very happy that someone has finally decided to put the hammer on him, because this man deserves to be punished. He was a brutal military official who, you know, cried baby tears in front of the court, and because he cooperated with U.S. authorities and indeed helped to get certain convictions in Chile, they let him off without serving any jail time. And I'm delighted now that the relatives of Winston Cabello have found the attorneys to do this job. I think it's a long overdue.
But Sean Roberts, what kind of prison sentence does he actually face, Fernandez Larios?
Well, our office actually is not able to initiate criminal proceedings against him. That's up to the U.S. government. What we have initiated here is a civil lawsuit, which will create a historical record with regard to his responsibility in these different killings and hopefully push the U.S. government to look harder at what it is that Fernandez Larios is responsible for having done during his years as a Chilean soldier under Pinochet, and will take extra steps to either remove him from the United States or prosecute him criminally. His criminal prosecution in the United States is by no means an easy matter to demand because of the fact that these were crimes that were committed in Chile and many, many years ago. Right now, the United States, if these crimes were committed in Chile, the United States would have jurisdiction to indict him in the United States because of the fact that in 1994, the U.S. ratified the U.S. The United Nations Convention Against Torture, which obligates the United States in cases where they believe that perpetrators of human rights violations are in the United States to either extradite or prosecute these individuals on U.S. soil. But because this crime was committed before the U.S. ratified the Torture Convention in 1994, it's not clear whether the United States would be able to prosecute him in the United States for these crimes that we're talking about.
Well, Sean Roberts, I want to thank you very much for being with us, legal director of the Justice and Accountability Project based in San Francisco. You held your news conference yesterday announcing the serving of the papers on the lawsuit against Fernandez-Larios and Zita Cabello, sister of Winston Cabello, plaintiff in the lawsuit. So, Orlando, I'd like to ask if you could stay with us till after the break for a minute. I want to get your comment on what we expect to hear tomorrow, which is the Law Lord of Britain, and what their decision will be on whether Pinochet will be extradited to Spain. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, the whole show will be devoted to Augusto Pinochet, because as we go on the air, we expect the Law Lords of Britain to be announcing their decision on whether or not Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile, will be extradited to Spain. So, Landau, you certainly have covered Chile extensively, done films, and also written the book Assassination on Embassy Row. You're currently at Pomona, California State Polytechnic University there. What have you heard and what do you expect to hear tomorrow?
Well, the leaks from the British press, the Guardian and the Observer, is that the Lords are going to muddy the waters rather than make a clear and courageous decision. That is, they're going to say that Pinochet did not enjoy sovereign immunity from crimes he committed. However, under British law, he can't be prosecuted because for crimes committed before 1988, because the British government had not ratified the anti-torture treaty until that year. And thus, if Spain is to extradite him, they must do so on crimes committed post-1988, which would, of course, limit to a great extent what the Spanish case could be against Pinochet. Now, that's what's the rumor coming out of England. We don't know this to be true yet. But that is one very, very heavy speculation. Now, Amy, it's important to understand that this, even if this comes down and it is determined that the Spanish prosecution can be very limited, listeners should really remember that there are many, many other options to take against the man who is known now as the world's longest English patient. I think it's over 5 months. First of all, there are rumors that the Justice Department has been preparing a case to indict him for the conspiracy to murder Orlando Letelier in Washington. Now, if this is true, it could be a very, very important development, because there the United States could then issue an extradition order to bring Pinochet to Washington to try him for conspiracy to assassinate. Now, that, I believe, is covered by routine extradition. So that would be a very, very significant break in the case. And I would say that people should urge General Reno to pursue this case diligently. You remember President Clinton, when he went before the United Nations announced that he had zero tolerance for terrorism. Well, they have applied this, how should I say, selectively, this doctrine. Now it's time to show that he had zero tolerance for Pinochet's terrorism in Washington, D.C., for the murders of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt. Now, I think General Reno has probably had a chance, or is indeed now reviewing the evidence against him. And I think listeners should be reminded that two of the former FBI agents who led the investigation on the Letelier-Moffitt case have both publicly stated that in their mind it is inconceivable that these murders took place without General Pinochet's authorization. Further, the prosecutor of the case, Larry Barcella, who is now in private practice, has testified to that before Judge Garcon, the Spanish judge who's hearing the Pinochet case in Spain. Now, that's pretty heavy coming from the two top investigators for the FBI and the U.S. attorney, the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case. Indeed, there are many, many documents today being declassified, and we only hope that the shredding machines aren't working overtime in CIA and DIA and other places, so that the information that the U.S. government collected on this case and other cases involving crimes that Pinochet committed can be revealed to the public. And indeed, they should be revealed to the public. And so that's what I think is going on now, Amy.
Well, Saul Landau, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And again, tomorrow we will spend the show on Augusto Pinochet as the law lords will be making their decision public when we expect to go on air tomorrow. And we hope to broadcast that live. Saul Landau joining us from California State Polytechnic University at Pomona in California, Pacifica Radio News commentator and author of Assassination on Embassy Row about the Letelier-Moffitt murder. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, Amy, and people ought to celebrate no matter which way the verdict goes, because it's been a major victory, even at this point, for human rights law. And all human rights violators, at least, are having some qualms about their future travel plans.
Well, thank you, Saul, for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Let's see, how does the Christian Science Monitor describe it on the front page today? Jonathan Lande writes, if NATO launches a bombing attack on Yugoslavia, the United States will be fighting two simultaneous conflicts for the first time since World War II. In addition to the low-level air war the U.S. has been waging for months over Iraq, U.S. ships and planes have been awaiting only the last-ditch mission to Belgrade yesterday by U.S. envoy Richard Holbrooke before launching strikes on Serb forces. Today we're going to talk about this issue, what's going on in Kosovo, as well as what's going on in Iraq. And we're also going to talk about Yasser Arafat's meeting today with President Clinton. But on the issue of the U.S. bombing of Iraq that has been going on almost unnoticed by the corporate press, it has been noticed, to say the least, in Saudi Arabia. The bombings have strained U.S. relations with the kingdom. While it's first allowed U.S. and British warplanes to take off from its soil to conduct air raids against Iraq, senior Saudi officials have recently refused to allow U.S. warplanes based there to take part in what it regards as punitive raids. The kingdom is the main base for U.S. warplanes in the region, and its stand has forced the United States to tailor its tactics in what's become a low-level war against Iraq by relying more heavily on Navy aircraft and on warplanes at other bases. We're joined right now by two people to talk about what's going on in Iraq and also Kosovo. We're joined by Hussein Ibish, media director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Farhan Haq, who is the United Nations correspondent for the Interpress Service, a third world news agency. Farhan Haq, let us begin with you, looking at these two fronts and how they're being regarded at the United Nations.
Well, the Kosovo matter is not really being regarded by the United Nations as yet, part of the reason being, of course, that NATO is so dominating this. And a lot of what is happening is discussions between NATO on the one side and Russia on the other. Whether those will actually make their way to the United Nations is a different question because, of course, in the UN Security Council, Russia, as well as China, have veto power. and would be likely not to authorize any sort of involvement that of the sort that the United States is envisioning, which is a very one-sided affair where NATO essentially is invited in under extreme force to police an accord. The Iraq matter is a very different case because the United Nations is committed to deal with this matter by the middle of April, and has and currently there are several UN panels. Experts on disarmament issues, experts on sanctions and the effects of the UN sanctions that have been in place since 1990, who are meeting right now in preparation for the April Security Council meetings, which are designed to focus on where the United Nations goes from there, because the United Nations is not in the least bit united about what to do with Iraq. And the reason for that is the low-level war that the United States and Britain are executing almost on a daily basis with Iraqi air missile defenses. And the United Nations hasn't been united on this issue since December 14th, when the United States and Britain launched 4 days of attacks on Iraq. And it doesn't seem as if there is any ability to build unity right now, with Russia, China, and France all insisting on an easing or an end of UN sanctions, and very little support for the sort of UN weapons monitoring that had been the crux of the UN involvement in Iraq for the past several years until the December attacks.
How much anger is being expressed at the United Nations by Arab countries and other countries over the U.S.-British bombing? And we should also say of Iraq that whenever we talk about the no-fly zones, we're very, quick to say these are U.S.-British imposed no-fly zones over Iraq, not
UN
imposed.
And French. There's a lot of anger, but a lot of it is still bubbling over in private. Many ambassadors privately say that what they're waiting for is the April meetings, where they're trying to build up as much support for an end to sanctions and for a serious review of controversial matters like the no-fly zone. The problem with the no-fly zone is that even though the United Nations has never authorized this, the United States, France, and Britain are three of the powerful veto-holding members of the Security Council and have basically blocked any effort to debate the legality of this or whether or not this is even justified under other UN resolutions. The United States tries to argue that it's justified by, vaguely by other UN resolutions that call for the protection of the Kurds or for the protection of the Shia Muslims who live predominantly in Iraq's south. Now, there has been more debate ever since the December bombings broke the unity of the council. There has been more debate about all sorts of issues that the United States never wants to talk about. For example, Malaysia, which is on the Security Council but which does not have the sort of veto power that the United States has, tried about 2 months ago to bring up the no-fly zones in a discussion of Iraq, and were quickly cut off by the U.S. and Britain. Russia is also becoming more irate about these matters, and all of the critics of the U.S. policy are focusing particularly on the U.N. weapons inspectors, who 2 months ago were revealed by several papers, such as the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, to have had U.S. spies, U.S. intelligence agents, working as members of the U.N. special committee that's entrusted with disarming Iraq. That body has become one of the focuses of the opposition, of the opponents of the current Iraq policy. And then the other big focus of opposition has been the sanctions regime, which even countries like France, who had been supportive in the past, are now asking to be phased out and replaced by checks on the way that Iraq spends its money when sanctions are lifted, but not any further total UN embargo, which is what you have in place now.
Farhan Haq, UN correspondent for Interpress Service. Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Washington, D.C. How is this playing among your constituency, the almost constant U.S. bombing of Iraq?
Well, I think it's playing horribly. People are appalled. They're absolutely enraged and infuriated. Even the Arab governments, which are those who are completely opposed to Saddam Hussein, those who are at odds with Iraq's policy, those that are very, very close to the United States, one could even describe them as dependencies and protectorates of the United States, such as some of the Gulf countries, even they are vociferously, publicly denouncing these attacks. And one of the most striking things is the breathtaking lies that you hear. And I use that word advisedly, the breathtaking lies by people like Secretary of Defense Cohen and other American officials who go and tour the Persian Gulf in Egypt and come back saying that the Arab world is united behind this policy, when almost every single government, except for the government of Kuwait, has publicly denounced these attacks in the most vociferous manner possible. So obviously it's not playing well at all. It's engendering hatred. It's engendering resentment, because there are multiple ironies behind this. First of all, the no-fly zones, as you pointed out before, are completely illegal and based on nothing except caprice and a might makes right kind of logic. In other words, they're imposed by the West because the West can do it. We're supposedly for the protection of civilians. Now you have scores of Iraqi civilians being killed, being murdered, in the supposed attempt to enforce these no-fly zones, which are allegedly for their own protection. It's a bizarre irony, and it can't possibly be justified. It reveals, the so-called enforcement of these so-called no-fly zones for the kind of fraud and sham that it is. It's not for the protection of anybody. It's for trying to bring down Saddam Hussein. Similarly, until recently, the bombings of Iraq were always justified on the grounds that Iraq was not cooperating with UNSCOM, and as it also has been pointed out, UNSCOM, in fact, was a nest of American spies, as the Iraqis were saying. So that has been conveniently forgotten by everyone, that, in fact, Iraq was, it had every justification for not cooperating with UNSCOM, but we've moved on, and we've cooked up some new pretexts and excuses for going along with this. Similarly, the U.S. attempts to invoke international law, to justify this absolutely unjustifiable, unprovoked aggression on a daily basis. And insofar as civilians are being killed, and as I say, scores of them have been, and by the way, these missiles are flying all over the place. Some of them have landed in Iran. And as I said, many civilian areas have been attacked, whether deliberately or in the course of this, what is otherwise an international felony as well. And frankly, when civilians get killed in the course of these unjustified, illegal, lawless actions, I think that can very easily be described, as an act of terrorism. In fact, it's openly designed to terrorize the Iraqi people in order to try to get them to the point where they're willing to overthrow their own government because the United States wants them to have a different government. And I think that this, again, does not play well in the Arab world. And finally, the U.S. invokes Security Council resolutions, especially the Gulf War ceasefire resolutions, which fail to justify any of this aggression. But at the same time, those very self-same U.N. Security Council resolutions guarantee the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iraq, all of which are being sort of ruthlessly and blatantly violated on a daily basis. So the multiple ironies, the outstanding hypocrisy, breathtaking lies all compound each other to make this one of the truly most appalling policies that we've seen in the 1990s.
Hussein Nibish, what about what's happening today in Washington, D.C., the meeting between Yasser Arafat and Bill Clinton, and the significance of this? The 125-member PLO body will have the final word next month on whether Palestinians will declare independence May 4th. Arafat meeting today with Clinton, he says he will declare independence in the West Bank and Gaza on May 4th when that five-year interim period of self-rule ends under the Oslo Accord, which both the Israelis and the Palestinians signed in 1994.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it's obvious that the meeting is designed for Clinton to try to pressure Arafat, to continue the pressure on Arafat not to declare independence. However, the Palestinians cannot allow May 4th to go by. It's not an arbitrary date that they made up. It is when the period of transition from self-rule to independence, as certainly is clearly implied in the interim accord and the other Oslo process documents, is supposed to take place. And ever since the election of Netanyahu, the Israelis have stonewalled on all of their previous agreements, except for redeployment from Hebron, which they renegotiated and divided the city between 400 settlers, on the one side and 140,000 Palestinians on the other side. Other than the redeployment from Hebron, they've conducted and fulfilled none of their existing obligations, and they've signed other agreements, including the Y Memorandum, of which they have lived up to none of their agreements. The Palestinians have been doing at least some of the things that they said that they would. Even the State Department admits that the Palestinians have been fulfilling their obligations. The Israelis have not been. Essentially, with Netanyahu, you've got a man who inherited a peace process which he doesn't believe in, and he campaigned against. His mandate when he was elected was one of hostility and opposition to the existing accord. So obviously, he's not going to enforce the treaties. He's not going to live up to his obligations. And if he signs new ones, he's just going to repudiate them 2 or 3 days after he signs them, because it is his ambition and the ambition of most of his cabinet to settle and finally annex most of the West Bank. I mean, this is what it is. It is not an agenda that can lead to peace or independence or justice or decency. It just isn't. Now, as long as this is the case, I think the Palestinians are put in a very difficult situation. However, however tempting it may be for them to declare statehood on May 4th, there's a lot of pressure on them not to do it. So I think that probably they would not go for a fully fledged declaration of independence, but at the same time, they can't let this date pass without anything happening. So you may see some sort of half-hearted measure coming out of there. The problem is that the United States is so absolutely one-sided in this matter, and is so blindly and uncritically supportive of every whim of any Israeli prime minister that, in fact, the United States, I think, is bound to oppose this, whether just or not, whether good for peace or not, whether it's the only, even given the fact that it's the only moral outcome and the only one which promises any kind of stability. So it, in a sense, I think we're looking at a very, very difficult moment in May 4th.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, Hussein Ibish, about this Terry Anderson lawsuit, the journalist who is held hostage for more than 6 years in Lebanon, who's suing the Iranian government for what he says is its role in his imprisonment.
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously he's got the right to sue, but we've seen other people sue the Iranian government and win in, under very dubious circumstances, to be honest with you. And then they've been awarded large settlements, and there's no way for them to collect, because essentially the United States government is not interested in doing further damage to its relations with Iran, and to try to bend and twist international law to give American courts that kind of jurisdiction over the Iranian government. For example, the United States government could unfreeze some of the assets of the Iranian government that have been frozen since the Iranian Revolution, that were essentially assets of the government of the Shah, and give them to those who've won settlements against the Iranian government, or those who've won, verdicts against the Iranian government, and the Iranians have been ordered to pay compensation. But the United States government has declined to do this. It would be, I think, a dubious measure under international law. And I think that it would be provocative. So I would say, Terry Anderson is likely to find himself suing an absent defendant, an absent respondent. And if he wins, he's not likely to be able to collect. So in a sense, it's pretty symbolic, and I don't think it's going to have any effect.
Hussein Ibish, I want to thank you for joining us, media director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. It's based in Washington, D.C., and also thanks to Farhan Haq of the Interpress Service based at the United Nations. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, as probably most of you have heard, on Sunday night there were hundreds of protesters outside the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles protesting this year's Lifetime Achievement Academy Award, which was given to director Ilya Kazan, director of On the Waterfront, A Streetcar Named Desire, and so many other films, who in 1951 informed on many of his Hollywood colleagues before the House Un-American Activities Committee. The protesters included some of those on Kazan's blacklist, as well as their family members and supporters. And on Friday, we did a special on the Kazan controversy. As Kazan received his award, many inside the pavilion chose not to clap, like Nick Nolte and Ed Harris. Well, we got a phone call from one of the organizers of the protest, Joni Seckler, and we thought it would be instructive to play because these protests don't happen without organizing, and she gives us a little insight into what actually did take place.
Hi, Amy. This is Joni Seckler in L.A. It's Monday, about 1 o'clock my time. I wanted to just give you a follow-up on the Kazan protest, of which I've been one of the people spearheading this whole campaign for the last 5 weeks. Just to let you know that we're over 500 people at the protest demonstration at the Academy's Dorothy Chandler Pavilion yesterday. There was a lot of support in the limousines with people waving and raising their fists, etc. And there were two reporters today who both said that, well, one said that only 40% of people stood up and clapped for Kazan, and that was Roger Ebert of Siskel and Ebert. And the other person today in the Daily Variety, Army Archer, said that he was sitting and he didn't think more than 20% of the people stood up to clap for Kazan. So I think this is a real victory because we only had 5 weeks to organize this. We got 350 names for an ad that went into the trades. We had a big press conference. We had at least 200 media outlets from around the world interviewing the blacklistees. And then we had this wonderful demonstration of over 500 people. So we are planning to do more, and we're going to be meeting at the end of the week to talk about other activities that we want to have planned.
And that was Joni Seckler, one of the organizers of the Ilya Kazan protest outside the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles, where the Oscars ceremony took place on Sunday night. We'll let our listeners know what else is planned. Well, speaking of performances, I just came back from San Francisco, the National Federation of Community Broadcasters Conference, celebrating 50 years of community radio, because actually that's 50 years of Pacifica Radio, which began community radio in 1949 with our first station in Berkeley, California, KPFA. And we thought we'd end today on a lighter note, and that is with feminist comic Marilyn Pittman, who addressed the NFCBers, the representatives of community radio around the country.
You know, as a comic, the things you talk about are the things that burn inside you, the things that drive you crazy, the things that cause you, well, if you're in pain and you're a comic, you know this is going to be great material as soon as you get out of pain. No, isn't it? And if you're angry and you're a comic, you know, man, this is going to make into something really good, right? And I was thinking about this and about the technology and about the culture and you know, we've come a long way in the civil rights movements of all different minorities. We've come a long way in some ways, and then we still have so far to go. And we're just living in such a crazy world. And I was thinking about this, and I thought, why is the culture seem to be moving so slowly, you know? Racism, sexism, homophobia. And yet the technology keeps driving us faster and faster and faster. The technology, the rhythm of the technology has changed our lives. I mean, think about it. I can fax, phone, email, beeper. I can get instant cash, instant credit, instant sex if I wanted it, but I'm not going to tell you that. I mean, I've gotten so used to the speed of technology that I can't even listen to a busy signal anymore. Have you tried this? Like, oh man, get call waiting, get voicemail, get with it. You know, no wonder we freak out when the technology stops, when the computer crashes, when the traffic comes to a halt. Hey, up yours, buddy, get out of my way! We've all snapped in some way, at least here in the urban areas. I know myself, I can't be trusted. I can't. I'm crazy. I drive everywhere. Why? Why do I drive everywhere? Because I have to rush around so that I can get all my errands done, so that I can hurry home, so that I can relax.
Ah.
You know, I feel like I'm urgent to be mellow. I'm urgent to be mellow. Hey, up here, look at it. I'm late for my mindfulness mantra and meditation class. I'm trying to relax. Get out of my way, up here. Get out of my way. I gotta get home so I can nap. What the hell's happened here? You know, this is just insane. And why do the pedestrians act like they never drive? Have you noticed this here in the Bay Area, the California? Californians, they act like they never drive. Oh, like, no, I'm a pedestrian. I'm being organic, and I'm not polluting the environment. Get out of my way. You know, like, oh, yeah, well, I'm driving a car. You're dead. All right. You know, I hate that arrogance, yeah. I don't know, maybe screaming at each other is a frustrated... I thought about this a lot. I thought maybe it's our way of connecting. Maybe we're all yelling at each other because we're just trying to connect. You know, like how you have a fight with your lover in order to feel close? Is this just my miserable life? Thanks for your support. You know, you fight and you just want to connect because really I think the technology can be very dehumanizing. Haven't you ever reached the person you were trying to reach and then felt just a little disappointed? Oh, hi, it's you. I thought I'd get voicemail. Huh? Have we all been there? Yeah, get out of my way. You're human. I just want to leave a message. And I want to talk about myself, please. And speaking of talking about yourself, what about the cell phone craze? What in the hell has happened to people? You know, I'm on the corner of 4th and self-importance here. Yeah, uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, here I am. I'm turning the corner now. Okay, oh, I'm getting out of the car now. Okay, I'm walking into the house. Okay, I'm walking up the steps. Okay, honey, I'm standing in front of you. Oh, hi, honey. I'll be right back. I got to check my voicemail. You know, because voicemail, everybody got to check their voicemail. Voicemail, voicemail. And you got to give good voicemail. What's that like if you don't give good voicemail? If you're not good at it. Talk to me. I'm a voice coach. But if you don't, you're like, blah, 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 blah. And then afterwards, you're like, did I say asshole? Oh, my God. Did I say jerk? What an idiot. I sound like an idiot. And you can't rewind it. You can't reproduce it. You can't retake it like you can in good quality radio production. There it is. It just goes out there into the Ethernet, and everyone's got their little black box with all your little hems and haws and little, I don't know who I am kind of moments. Don't you hate that? You know, and that's why we want to leave email. Email is the best because you can really craft the message. You know, you can really think about it, but voicemail's like, oh, hi, I'm really insecure and I hope you love me. All right. Or is this just my miserable life? All right. I'm a performer. Of course I'm insecure. It goes with the territory. But it just seems to me that, well, if you think about the technology too, I feel like, I was looking at my accounts the other day. You know, I got all these accounts. Everybody's got accounts of this and that and this. And I thought, you know what? I have too many PIN numbers. There are just too many PIN numbers. I have a PIN number for my checking account. I've got a PIN number for my savings account. Now I've got a PIN number for the phone information for my checking account. And then I've got a different PIN number for the phone information for my savings account. And I've got a PIN number for the internet account and a PIN number for my email and a PIN number for AOL. And it goes on like this. It's like, I don't know, which one is it? Which one is this? Which one is it? My mother's maiden name or my date of birth or my social security number or my zip code? Oh, damn, I can't remember. Oh, man. Wait, oh, some of them want the pound sign. Some of them don't. You know, why can't we just have, like, one,
just one Orwellian number for everything? Well, I've got my number, I've got your number, I've got your number. Do you know your number? You better not forget your number.
Oh, no. I can't. What's my number? What's my number? And the machine's, dun, 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 dun. And if you don't punch it in the same rhythm, dun, 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 then you go, dun, 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 dun. Oh, then all of a sudden, you know, the headlights and they're like, Miss Pittman. Why can't we just have one number? You know, just one four-digit number. You know, and then you just can't forget it, because if you do, then I can't get cash. Oh, my God, I can't get credit. I can't even buy food. I can't even think anymore. I'm going crazy. Why do you think there are so many homeless people? These are the people who forgot their PIN numbers. It's okay. A polite smattering of applause will do. I've done a lot of work on myself. I don't need you. All right. Filled with self-love every day. Whatever. Are there news people? A lot of news people here? I'm a news person, former news person. I work with news people all the time. And I got to tell you, I don't know about you, but here's one of my dark little secrets. I'm a news junkie. I am. It's kind of, I feel like I need to get a program, you know, like News-Anon or something. I need to go somewhere and help get some help. Because I actually, and here's how I knew that this one time when I was watching date time or whatever the hell, Line Prime 2020, 4090, a bunch of sensational crap from the networks. And I was watching a reenactment of a guy who froze to death in his pickup truck in the mountains. A reenactment of a guy who froze to death in his pickup truck in a snowstorm in the mountains. And I just kept watching it. And watching it. Waiting for the guy to die. I wanted to watch the guy die. We agreed our lives were powerless over the news. Didn't take acid in the 60s here. Watch the nightly news! It's just very surreal, don't you think? So, actually, I worked in television news for a little while, but I accidentally said a swear word in the outtake. It was a recording of the news because I wasn't feeling well, and the outtake went on the air. It's true, back in Albuquerque, at this little crappy station on the West Mesa. It was in those old days when they had Hitachi cameras. And they didn't have viewfinders. They thought, we don't have to have that labor to run those cameras. Let's have a remote control camera. And this, you know, if I moved, the slide would cover my face, and my face was green, stuff like that. So maybe it was like a Freudian slip or something, but I said a swear word, and they got rid of me. I didn't mean to. It was an outtake. And I won't tell you what the word is, but.
You are listening to feminist comic Marilyn Pittman, who is addressing the broadcasters at the National Federation of Community Broadcasters Conference this weekend in San Francisco. For a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. And we have some deeply, deeply sad news to bring you at the end of Democracy Now! Today. Our beloved program director at Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York, Samori Marksman, died in his sleep last night. Our deepest condolences go out to his entire family, and his family goes beyond his wife and his three children and his brothers and sisters. It extends to so many people in New York and this country and around the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! So listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings.